Well, it's a pleasure to be here. As mentioned, I'm from North Ogden, and so I feel right at home. And if you want to see any of my dad's paintings, he's got a gallery on 25th Street here. So in your break time, go buy some paintings. It'll help my dad out. So I'm really excited to talk a little bit about my passion of genetic disorders of bone fragility. And hopefully this will be of interest in terms of trying to differentiate non-accidental trauma, recurrent fractures with various genetic disorders. I have nothing to disclose related to this presentation. I wish I did, but I don't. So just a little clinical picture. Let's say that you see a four-month-old boy presents, it's actually a girl, sorry, but a four-month-old who presents with decreased movement of the left arm. You do a radiograph and you show this fracture of the radius. So what do you do now? Hopefully, you know, if it's a five-year-old who disobeys the AAP guidelines of jumping on the trampoline, it's a different situation. Here you have a four-month-old, so obviously some red flags should be in place. You decide to do a very detailed physical examination looking for any signs or symptoms. And the next step would be probably to do a skeletal survey. And on this skeletal survey, what you note is a number of other fractures, and you can see the fracture of the humerus, you can see another fracture of the forearm, you see the bowing of the leg, and you see this other fracture of the femur. And this child ended up to have osteogenesis imperfecta. And so we're going to go through a lot of the differential diagnosis for recurrent fractures. And of course, non-accidental trauma should be high on your list. There are lots of other secondary osteoporosis conditions where from GI complications, oncologic abnormalities, endocrine abnormalities, they can lead to secondary osteoporosis. And then there are other rickets and idiopathic forms. But today we're going to concentrate on some of the genetic disorders that lead to bone fragility. And there's a large list here, and we're going to concentrate on those that are probably most common that would be confused with recurrent fractures where there are no other obvious symptoms that would say, oh, that you would never confuse this with just ordinary fractures. And also concentrate on some of the genetic disorders in which there are treatment, where treatment is available. And so just the outline of what I'm going to talk about, I'm going to first focus on what some of the bone cellular functions so that we understand what are the, when you have defects in certain cells, how does that impact propensity for fracture, some of the bone morphometry and fracture propensity based on the morphometry of the bone, and then focus on the genetic syndromes that are associated with fracture, and then evaluation and treatments that are available. So when we think about bone cells, this is very simplistic, but in my mind, there are three types of bone cells. They're the osteoclasts, so these are macrophages, and they lead to bone resorption. Osteoblasts are from the mesenchymal lineage, and they are responsible for bone formation. They make osteoid that then mineralizes and becomes our bone. And then osteocytes are actually osteoblasts that have finally differentiated into the final cell that then maintains this exchange of nutrients. And so if we have defects or genetic defects that impact any of these bone cellular functions, you can have abnormalities in bone. And you can have abnormalities in how the bone is formed, but in addition, you can have abnormalities in how the bone is maintained. Besides those bone cells, then you can have abnormalities in collagen. So our bone is made up of organic and inorganic components. Collagen provides that flexibility. It's a triple helix. And the mineral, mineral components, calcium, phosphorus, hydroxyapatites, they are deposited within these collagen fibrils and form our bone. There's many types of collagen, but in bone, type 1 collagen is essentially the only type of collagen that we see in bone. And then once you have your bone is developed, our bone is constantly being remodeled. Our bone is constantly being turned over. And the bone remodeling process starts with osteoclasts that lay down on the bone, release enzymes that degrade the bone, and then the osteoblasts come behind them and fill in that bone. and restructure that bone. So if there's an abnormality in either of this process, you can have either excess bone, excess density of bone, or you can have abnormalities where you don't create enough bone. For example, if you are an astronaut, you're not going to have loading of your bone. Your osteoblasts are not triggered to create bone, and so you develop an osteoporosis. And it's the same with immobility. For example, individuals with cerebral palsy will develop osteoporosis and fractures because they don't have that normal sensors for this mechanostat that allows for normal bone remodeling. And then the function of bone. What causes a fracture? You get a force placed upon a bone, and it leads to a point where it breaks. So you can have multiple factors that relate to fractures. You can have a problem with the quantity of bone, the amount of bone that you have, or the quality. So the geometric shape, the microarchitecture of the bone, mineral content and density, or the actual collagen structure and cross-linking. And so I'm going to talk about some of the common genetic disorders of bone fragility. And the most common and the one that is often confused with just repeat fractures or even non-accidental trauma is osteogenesis imperfecta. And this is due to defects in type 1 collagen. And you have this triple helix that, for collagen, it's a triple helix. We'll talk a little bit about what are the signs of OI, what is the biology of osteogenesis imperfecta, and what's the genetics of osteogenesis imperfecta. And so fractures are the key finding in osteogenesis imperfecta. And I think there are many of you that see buccal fractures all the time. These are actually patients with osteogenesis imperfecta. So how on a radiograph do you tell that somebody has osteogenesis imperfecta? We're going to talk about some of the other signs, but I think this is a pretty typical buccal fracture that you'd see in the general population. Here's an infant. An infant who had a fracture and that also has OI. I think nowadays with our radiographs, it's very hard to tell if someone is osteopenic, but you can get an idea if somebody has osteopenia, and these x-rays show some osteopenia. But then, from those mild fractures, you get a wide range where you get very severe bowing, deformities, significant fractures. And so there's a large spectrum when we look at osteogenesis imperfecta. And these are some of the crumpled bone appearances, the very bowed, almost accordion-like fractures that we see in the more severe OIs. And then another finding on radiographs are what we call codfish vertebra, where the vertebral bodies look like fish because of these compression fractures that we see on radiographs. But one of the key things when we're looking at a skeletal survey, and why do we get a skeletal survey, is to try to find signs that there's an underlying genetic disorder of bone fragility. And wormium bones are, if you see wormium bones, you'd think specifically about OI. And so we get skeletal surveys not just to look for fractures, recurrent fractures, but do they get wormium bones? And it actually is not because they look like worms, but it was because it was named for a doctor, Dr. Verm. So they are these, islands of bone within the sutures in the skull. And you can see these little islands of bones within the sutures. And those are wormium bones, and that they're very specific for osteogenesis imperfecta. We don't see them all the time, so the absence of them is not helpful, but the presence of them are very helpful when we're looking at an infant with multiple fractures, and particularly in the evaluation of whether or not there's a non-accidental trauma. A small portion of individuals with OI will also have this dentinogenesis imperfecta, so very translucent teeth and enamel, but once again, that's not seen in a large majority of individuals, but when you do see it, it's pretty specific for osteogenesis imperfecta, and individuals with osteogenesis imperfecta need very diligent dental care. One of the hallmarks is blue sclera. Another problem with blue sclera is you don't see it in everybody that has OI. You can have normal sclera and still have osteogenesis imperfecta. However, this is a family of mine, three-generation family, and these are the three generations, and you can see that bluish, gray-blue sclera. And so if you're seeing a kid that has multiple fractures, even just one fracture, always take a look at the sclera. If it looks blue, that should be a significant trigger for you to think further about whether or not they have an underlying problem with bone fragility that could be genetic. However, this is a child with a severe OI, in fact, was that first patient that I showed you, where the sclera is basically normal. It's not significantly blue, and infants have a slightly grayish tint to their sclera as well, which makes it difficult, but there's significant variability. So the types of OI, when we think about types, I'm not a big fan of the types because there's significant overlap. And for some reason, when they named the types, they didn't do it in order, so in order severity. So type 1 is the milder type. Type 4 is the moderate to mild type. Type 3 is the severe type. And type 2 is the lethal type. But as you can see, there is significant overlap when we think about the clinical variability. And these were named before we understood the genetics and the pathophysiology of OI. And so I'm going to go into that a little bit more on what is the actual genetics and how this actually tells us why somebody could be lethal versus somebody could have just a fracture or two. So, but in general, the four types still stand up. And when we think about clinical evaluation and whether or not somebody has OI and we want to give them anticipatory guidance, we go through these types. There's the mild severity of OI, where they have an annualized fracture rate of less than one. They usually have straight long bones, minimal vertebral crush fractures. They have normal growth, fully ambulant. They rarely miss school. Their bone density isn't dramatically low. And these are most people that have type 1 OI. The moderate type of OI is an annualized fracture rate of greater than one, so they have more than one fracture a year. They have bowing of the long bones, usually from the repeated fractures, some vertebral crush fractures. They are absent from school, often from pain and fractures. And they usually have this type 3, or kind of the type 4, actually more the type 4 rather than the type 3, because our type 3 is the more progressive, severe OI, where they have deformities of the bone that are unrelated to the actual fractures. They just have such bad bone that they have this bowing. They usually are non-ambulatory. They are in wheelchairs, the mark impairment in linear growth, and they have the type 3 OI. And then there is the type 2, which is the lethal OI, rarely compatible with life. They have beaded ribs due to the multiple rib fractures, crumpled long bones, and it's a perinatal lethal course. And when we think about OI, when we look at the non-lethal OIs, and there are up to 12 types of OIs, but we're just going to ignore those other types because we don't really know what to do with those. But in general, the vast majority, 70% of non-lethal OIs, are the very mild type 1 OIs that you may see in your clinic that you may not even know that they have OI. So it's much more common to have the milder forms than to have the more severe and debilitating forms. So why is there such a large variation in the clinical phenotype? And we now know, based in new knowledge on the genetics of OIs, that these are due to the actual genetics. And when we think about mutations, if you have a missense mutation where there's just a glycine that leads to a glycine substitution, then that interferes with the actual normal collagen. So you still make the collagen protein, but it's a bad protein that interferes with the other protein, and you have a more severe course. Whereas the type 1 OI is due to nonsense or frameshift mutations that result in stop codons, where you get nonsense-mediated decay, and in essence, you get no protein made, and your body just has half the amount of collagen that it should have. And that's actually why, when you think about the type 1 OIs and you look at their sclera, that's just because they have less amount of collagen. And so the sclera is made up of collagen. And that's also why the type 4 OIs, they have normal sclera often because they have a normal amount of collagen, but just it's abnormal collagen. And so we now have a better understanding of why there's this range of severity, and we really can lump them into the type 1 where you just have half the amount versus the other types where you have bad collagen made that interferes with the normal collagen. And then even within those types, it's based on where is the mutation that leads to the unfolding of this triple helix. So you can see this huge abnormal protein would have more of an effect than a protein that is made that has a smaller effect. And so the type of mutation can help us predict what we have clinically. And this is a family, three generation that I talked about before. And these are autosomal dominant, as an autosomal dominant condition in 95% of the time due to mutations in the collagen 1A1 and the collagen 1A2 gene. But we now know that over just the past 3 or 4 years, we have found over 7 more new genes, and these are autosomal recessive genes. And this is important in the recurrence risk discussion with families, because if this is an isolated case, we can now do genetic testing to tell them if there's a 25% recurrence risk, or is this just an accident that happened and the recurrence risk is similar to the general population. And these are all genes that are due to collagen over-modification. And you should consider autosomal recessive forms in those that have the severe OIs, that have the moderate to severe. And there are some founder populations. So there are certain risk factors that would make you think, should I be considering that this is an autosomal recessive form rather than an autosomal dominant form of OI? So the question that I get is, when do we do genetic testing? The mutation analysis for the is pretty sensitive about 95% of the time. However, most of the time we can diagnose this on clinical grounds and don't need to do genetic testing. So in my mind, we do genetic testing if the diagnosis is uncertain, if there's a risk of non-accidental trauma, if there's an issue of recurrence risks, or if there is an issue in terms of what is the anticipatory guidance, such as lethal OIs. So with the lethal OIs and you know, should you withdraw support, those type of things, we can get a better idea from genetic testing. But now there is treatment. So that's one of the things that I think is encouraging. The use of bisphosphonates have been used a long time, but now intravenous bisphosphonates can be used. And bisphosphonates are taken up by osteoclasts. And then when the osteoclasts take up the bisphosphonate, they die off. And so basically, it results in a decrease in the bone resorbing cells. And in fact, these are patients of ours who get IV infusion, and we call them zebra lines. You can actually see the actual infusions when they get these bisphosphonate infusions. And we have an OI clinic at the Shrine where we give them IV bisphosphonate, and it decreases their fracture rate and pain. However, the efficacy of bisphosphonates is still not well known. Have a decade half-life for bisphosphonates. It does increase their bone density, but it's difficult to measure in OI patients. Does it really reduce their fracture rate significantly, and what impact does it have on the bone healing? And of importance, it actually does not repair the collagen defect. So all it does is increase the density of the bone, doesn't repair that collagen defect at all. So we still have a ways to go to see how we can improve fractures in this condition. But I think that it has improved. In fact, these are two children who had similar OI pictures, different in 35 years. One who was treated, who's been treated since 15 months of age with bisphosphonate, versus another individual that never received bisphosphonate therapy. So in the more severe OIs, I think it has made a significant difference in their ambulation, pain, and fractures. And as a geneticist, I'm always walking through Walmart and down the street trying to diagnose people. And I have this thing with one of my colleagues where we look at movies and try to diagnose people. And these are actually two people who have osteogenesis imperfecta. This is the actor from The Middle. I don't know if you've ever seen that show, but he has mild osteogenesis imperfecta. And then this is an actor who's been in Deadwood, and this is he was in David Lynch's The Twin Peaks film and TV series. And he has the type 3 severe, more severe OI type. And so it does show that kind of variability in the phenotype. So now I'm going to go through a few of the other genetic syndromes that sometimes can be confused. There's something called Brux syndrome that is very similar to OI. They have bone fragility, they have wormy in bones, but they also get contractures. And it's an autosomal recessive condition that's due to a gene called PLOD2 that has a defect in the lysyl hydroxylase that leads to the cross-linking. And then there's hypophosphatasia, which is a disorder that is due to a mutation that leads to low alkaline phosphatase levels, so basically they have no alkaline phosphatase. It's autosomal recessive, it's variable, mild to lethal, and in fact here is a patient of mine who had bowing and fractures, and at birth we measured the alkaline phosphatase and it was less than 20. And they get premature loss of teeth. Then there's neurofibromatosis type 1. They get bowing of the lower leg where it breaks and it doesn't heal. In fact, that first picture that I showed of the amputation is from a patient who had neurofibromatosis type 1. But I think this is important when you see a child who has comes in and has bowing and fracture, that this is that you look to see, are there any capillae spots? And in fact, these are some bone samples of patients with NF1. You can see the microarchitecture of the bones are abnormal because we know that NF1 impacts the osteoblasts and the osteoclasts compared to a control bone at the top. There's fibrous dysplasia. They have bone fragility, bone thinning due to mutations in GNAS1. Pretty specific on radiographs, you'll see this fibrous dysplasia, and it can cause significant fractures as well. And then an interesting condition called osteopetrosis. It's due to increases they get actual increase in bone density, so very high bone density, and it's a defect in the osteoclast. So they have mutations in genes that cause the osteoclast not to work, so the osteoclasts do not resorb the bone. And then rickets. We can't forget rickets. It's due to vitamin D deficiency leading to hypocalcemia, get bowed legs, fractures, the rachitic rosary, prevention with vitamin D and sun. And there are some X-linked dominant forms where that's vitamin D resistant. So when you see somebody that has a rickets appearance on x-rays and the no problems with vitamin D, you should think about could it be a genetic disorder as well. Genetic bone disorders are often confused with abuse, and so it is important when you're seeing a child who is suspected of having abuse from multiple fractures that you think about some of these conditions. We've had parents that have been wrongly imprisoned, and conversely, it makes it very difficult in terms of do we need genetic testing, and sometimes the courts demand that we have genetic testing in these situations. So my general initial workup for fractures are key. Thing to have a medical history, age, mechanism, physical examination, do they have capillae spots, family history is often not done. And so you might see, you know, well, has the parent had multiple fractures? It's very important to try to get that picture. After you've had a good physical exam, looking at the sclera, the growth, the limbs, if there's any concerns there, you proceed with a skeletal survey, biochemical testing for vitamin D, alkaline phosphatase, looking at hypophosphatasia, and then after those you should have a good idea of whether or not they should be referred to a geneticist and whether or not genetic testing is indicated. And just to mention also that hypophosphatasia, now there is a recombinant enzyme replacement that can be used, and so there is treatment for that condition as well. And thanks for your attention.
Do you have any experience with FOP disease?
Personally, I have not. I haven't seen any patients with that.
I have a granddaughter that has that. It's fibril ossification progressiva. And every bruise turns to bone, so they have to be very careful that she doesn't fall or have any accident. And that's a genetic disease, too.
There's a long list of genetic bone diseases, and we are working on getting a bone dysplasia clinic at the Shrine. Right now, it's focused mostly on osteogenesis imperfecta. Thanks.
Sorry, I have a question.
Oh, sorry.
I was just wondering if when you administer bisphosphonates to the children with osteogenesis imperfecta, does that make a difference in the fusion of the growth plates, or does that not have any effect on that?
It hasn't had any effect on the fusion of the growth plates that we are aware of. It's only used in the more severe OI types, and we don't have a large long-term experience with it, but it shouldn't really impact that because it's just having an effect on the osteoclasts.
All right.